supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows today, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about the difference between straw and hay and address this technique of straw bale gardening. We're also going to discuss the fabulous Garden Conservancy's Open Days program, in which otherwise private gardens are open to you for your viewing for a single day. It's the Brigadoon of gardening. Well, that's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Christy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. How are you?
I am fine, Christy. Thank you. Where are you?
Well, my house is in Edmond, Oklahoma, but I'm currently in Oklahoma City, real close.
I was going to say, from what I remember of my visits down there, you could have 1 foot in Oklahoma City and one in Edmond, couldn't you?
Yeah, you can.
You could be straddling the border. Probably. Yeah. So what can we do for Christy in Oklahoma?
I wanted to talk to you about an interesting problem that we had in the house. We just moved into this new house in Edmond, and we've lived there since December. We moved in December. Well, once springtime came and the birds and bees started doing their thing, we had a couple of bluebirds, and they're not blue jays, but I don't know what they are, but they're not blue jays, who have the previous owners had these little wooden bird houses sticking up out of the ground in the middle of the backyard.
Right.
And so they're really pretty birds. I mean, the male is bright blue wings, brighter than a blue jay. And the female has blue wings, but she has a little bit of a browner chest. But anyway, they made a nest, and I think they have babies. They're pretty protective of the little bird houses that are back there.
Mm-hmm.
But the female tries to get in our bedroom window almost every day. My husband works the night shift, so he tries to sleep in the morning, but she wakes him up. She sits at the windowsill outside and flutters up about 5 feet, tapping on the window and back down, and she does it over and over and over again. And this last Sunday morning, I woke up and got out of bed, and I looked over, and she was staring at us.
Christy, it's clear your husband is having an out-of-species affair. How can you be in such denial about this? I mean, the woman
is
coming.
Well, that's what we wondered, if the previous owners had some inappropriate relationship where they let the birds come in and sleep with them.
She's shameless.
I don't know, dinner together.
She's pecking at the window while the wife is home. This, birds should be ashamed.
I don't know what to do.
There's a couple of things that traditionally work well. And you're sure it's the female, it's the drabber bird who's coming to the window?
I think it is.
A lot of times male birds will attack their own reflection, you know, thinking it's competition.
Yeah.
And so they'll constantly
be
going in. Well, no, females don't act that way. Females are smarter than that. You know that. So, but she's obviously doing something. She might be looking for insects, or she might be looking for nesting material. Or there might be a reflection that's confusing her. So there is a product out there called Bird Scare Flash Tape. And what it is it's a roll of tape quite like an old reel-to-reel tape recorder tape. But it is made so that it reflects light crazily and it whistles in the wind and it snaps. And it's highly effective at keeping birds away. But this stuff works a zillion different ways, and the birds can't really get used to it. There's another technique, if it's easy enough for you to do, if you can get at the top of the window, you would string fishing line down every 6 inches and put a weight on the bottom and just have this screen that would be virtually invisible from outside and inside, but the birds would feel it, and it would make them not want to be there. And then, yes, you're also welcome to try the classic rubber snake, or to, you know, if there's a roof right over this window, nail a fake owl up there, something like that. But the first thing I would do is the bird scare flash tape.
Okay.
So, but that's what you want to do. You want to make it feel weird, look weird, or be
right.
totally inaccessible, even for a short period of time, and it
right.
should be fine.
Okay. Well, she doesn't know what's coming.
The hussy.
Thank you so much for your help. I really appreciate it. And I love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. We have a long history down in the Oklahoma City, Edmond area, and we're thrilled to have you with us.
Well, it was good talking to you, Mike.
You too. Take care. Good luck.
Thanks. Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. Hello. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Dave. Where are you?
I am in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, very good. Always nice to hear from our listeners there in the Yellow Springs area.
Yeah, well, actually, technically, I'm just outside of Dayton in Trotwood, Ohio, but it's right next door to Dayton, so we consider it Dayton. Got an issue with my front yard.
Okay.
We've been there since 95. In the first few years, we had a certain chemical lawn care treatment company coming, spraying the weed control and all that. It looked great for a while. And we decided to get away from that. And stopped using the service, and gradually the health of the lawn has deteriorated. We also had some planting beds we did around the house with some things like English ivy, which I know was probably a mistake.
Big mistake.
And
yeah.
we also had some plants that had some vinca vines that were incorporated with them, and we planted those plants in the bedded area. The vinca decided to take off, so now it's covering areas largely. But the biggest problem is the lawn itself is now becoming peppered with dandelions. So my question is, can it be saved? We need to...
Oh, sure.
Go to,
sure.
Okay.
So who cuts your lawn?
I do.
And how high is it when you're done cutting it?
I try to cut up fairly high, actually. I've got the lawnmower set at almost the highest setting.
Okay. I want you to do measurement, though, because your lawn okay. needs to be at least 3 inches after you're done cutting. And you fired the service, so has the lawn ever been fed since then?
No. I did some fertilizer once a couple years back. It was probably the wrong time of year to do it because I produced large brown streaks.
Yes, because you, you fertilized in the summer. You know, just because you got your lawn off drugs, which is a great thing, doesn't mean that it doesn't need proper care. So have you started cutting yet for the season?
Just did one cut the other day. Didn't touch much because it hadn't started growing that very
good,
much.
Good, good. Did you, before that, did you sharpen your blade or did you buy a new blade?
I sharpened the blade last year.
You have to do it every year. Always cut with a sharp blade.
Okay.
Be ready to feed your lawn with corn gluten meal in the fall as soon as the hot weather breaks.
Okay.
If you feed your lawn with corn gluten meal as soon as the summer heat breaks in the late summer, early fall, it'll give your lawn the feeding it needs to recover from the summer heat. It'll also mm-hmm. prevent the germination of a lot of future dandelions. Then when we get back around to the springtime, you should give your lawn a gentle feeding in the spring, mid-April.
Okay.
If dandelions are your issue, they germinate at the end of summer. And the corn gluten meal will prevent the germination of any seeds in the soil. And there's a lot of weed seeds that germinate then. So that will feed your lawn, and it'll knock back future dandelions. Now, there's a couple of tools you can go out to control the dandelions you have now that are tons of fun.
Yeah, okay.
My favorite is a flame weeder.
Flame weeder.
Yeah, go online. Burns-O-Matic, the people who make the little welding torches and stuff,
mm-hmm.
they make a product called the Yard and Garden Torch or the Outdoor Torch. Ideally, during a hot and dry spell, just wilt the dandelions.
Mm.
Just use the flame around them till they start wilting. You don't have to torch them. You don't have to burn them to the ground. Although, if it starts to get good for you, go right ahead.
Okay.
And then... also, keep an eye on them, and you're always going to miss some. And when those puffballs form,
mm-hmm.
go out with the flame weeder and just hit those puffballs.
Okay.
Oh, it's amazing. It's like Munchkin fireworks. It's absolutely
wow.
great.
Okay.
So knock back this year's, wilt them, burn the seed heads, make sure your blade is sharp, make sure you cut it 3 inches. And yes, dandelions are actually a sign of an underfed lawn. They're trying to restore some of the health of your lawn and break it up a little by growing in it. Is it pretty compacted as well, the soil?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. So this fall, after you use the corn gluten meal, look into having the lawn aerated with a core aerator. That's a machine that pulls plugs out of the ground.
Gotcha. Yeah.
If you do a core aeration and a corn gluten meal feeding as soon as the summer heat is over and you've kept the dandelions under control even a little bit this summer, you should have very few problems next year.
Okay. Now, as far as the English ivy and the vinca.
You're on your own on those, baby. Go to the website and read the articles that we have there under tough weeds. That's just going to be mano mano.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a very special talk on the best ways to turn your yard and garden waste and all those stinky scraps from your kitchen into true garden gold at the Burlington County Earth Fair in historic Smithville Park on Sunday, June 22nd. Don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, the Garden Conservancy's Open Days program that opens up private gardens for a single day every year, the difference between straw and hay, and lots more. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4. A cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what is the difference between straw and hay? It's a difference you better know if you intend to do, quote, straw bale gardening, which we'll also talk about, or more importantly, to use straw as mulch in your vegetable garden. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But as promised, it's time for our special guest, Laura Palmer, director of the Garden Conservancy's Open Days program, a great program that we have been talking about for years and years, and it's always a pleasure to remind people that these special events are happening all over the country, once-in-a-lifetime events. Laura Palmer, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
I'm happy to have you back. As you know, I'm a huge fan of the Open Days program, which, in a nutshell, is when people with fabulous private gardens, the kind of things maybe you see from the street all the time and wonder just what's inside those wrought iron gates, open up those fabulous private gardens for a single day for your organization so that you can raise money to preserve an endangered private garden somewhere.
That's right. This is actually our 20th season, so we've been doing this since 1995, and we're in 22 states this year with 325 really fabulous gardens. Of those, 113 of them are new, so people are creating those fabulous, exciting, exceptional gardens all around the country still.
Now, one thing I like to describe about your program is when one garden is open in a certain area, there's generally a whole bunch open on that same day. So it's like in baseball, hitting a ball into the right-hand corner. If you're a garden enthusiast, you can take as many as you can get to.
That's right. With few exceptions, we have some really terrific gardens who are off the beaten path that we just cannot pass up the opportunity to open them to people. So you'll see a few that are open on their own. Mostly they're because they have a fabulous collection of daylilies, or their daffodils are all blooming at the same time. So, you know, we will make an exception and open one or two on a day. But typically you can see it really on one day, about six gardens. You can buy some admission tickets from us and make your visits a little cheaper, and we have day passes available as well. So planning those days is pretty easy. We do a lot of the work for you.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not expensive under the best of terms, so to speak. It's $5 a garden, right?
That's right. Yep. It's a bargain.
Who needs a discount from $5 a garden, especially when the money's going to a good purpose? Now, is there a specific private garden that this year's Open Days program will benefit?
Well, most of our preservation work is ongoing and national and all around the country. So the money we raise through Open Days supports that general work. However, we do partner with our preservation projects when we are in town. For instance, the Houston Open Day benefits Peckerwood Garden, which is an extraordinary collection of plants that garden's creator John Ferry has collected over the years. So anyone that visits a Houston garden during the Open Day, a portion of those proceeds help us preserve Peckerwood. The same with our work in San Francisco to benefit the gardens on Alcatraz Island that we're restoring. Our San Francisco garden Open Days raise awareness for those projects in particular, and we do funnel some of that money to those projects.
And you've been working on the Alcatraz program for a while now.
We have. We started that program about 10 years ago. The restoration of the gardens that we were partnering with the Park Service to bring back are completed. So we're looking at other parts of the island to see what might be our next project there. But our 10-year initial restoration project just completed this year, so we're pretty excited about that. The gardens, if you haven't seen them lately, you have to go. You can see the ice plant blooming from San Francisco now. It's really an extraordinary project and an important garden for America.
One of the things about the Open Days program is it's like Brigadoon, but Brigadoon happens on a different day in different parts of the country. It's kind of a rolling series of events where you'll have, you know, one weekend and it'll be in the Philadelphia area. And then maybe a few months or weeks before or after that, it'll be in Texas. What are some of the big weekends coming up in like May and June that you're looking forward to?
Well, May, I always think of our Charleston, South Carolina Open Day. And, you know, Charleston's known for its beautiful, historic gardens in downtown. And we partner actually with the Spoleto Festival, which is in town at the same time that we are. It's the last two weekends in May. And we also partner with the Charleston Horticultural Society that helps us recruit the gardens and helps us put volunteers that know a lot about these gardens in the gardens on that day. So we have not only those downtown historic gardens open on one weekend, but then we've been very successful in identifying and finding those great gardens that are, you know, across the bridges and outside of Charleston, downtown Charleston and the historic district. So we encourage our visitors, when they do visit these private gardens that you just can't see any other time, to make a stop at the public garden in the area where you are. They're important places to support, too.
When are the Open Days in the Philadelphia area?
Well, the Philadelphia area, the closest we got to Philly this year is Bucks County, and we have two really great Open Days, one on June 28th and the other is July 19th. So our Philadelphia fans can certainly drive up to Bucks County on those afternoons and visit some really beautiful gardens. We're also back in Washington, D.C.
Oh, which that's I know great.
Which is a quick drive from Philadelphia as well. So those gardens aren't open until October, but you know, I encourage that our Philly fans, again, to hop in the car and plan a day.
Well, when it comes to the ability to tour an otherwise private garden, Bucks County is where Philadelphia people want to go. I mean, that's the greater area. How many gardens are open, and what are those dates again in Bucks County?
Six gardens on June 28th and another six on July 19th.
And I know you've added this emphasis on public gardens, but I have to tell you what has always piqued my interest is this ability on this single day to visit this home that maybe you've driven past so many times, mm-hmm. or you've walked past and you've seen flashes of color, and now here's a chance to walk through it for a day as if it were a public garden.
That's right. And I think the unique thing about open days is that the majority of our gardens, the host is there that day, and it's an opportunity to ask them questions about their successes and failures. The experience that we want to provide is an opportunity to see these beautiful places, but also learn from them. And I think that's a really special part of these opportunities.
Now, the open days program stretches out over a long season. When does it begin for you?
It begins earlier and earlier every year. It began in late March this year and continues into November.
And yeah, because I was curious when you said that the D.C. area is in the fall this year.
Yeah, and you know, at this time of year, particularly in the spring, there are so many garden tours. Certainly there are a lot of opportunities for people to participate in garden visiting. We find in the fall that it's just a less active time of year, and people really garden for even year-round interest now. We are always considering the opportunities we have to show gardens year-round. I mean, we know that there are people out there that have beautiful gardens in the winter, that where you can really see the bones of the garden. You can see the evergreen plantings.
Now, how many areas will be covered this year in the Open Days program, just vaguely?
We have about 127 open days. We're in 22 states, but if you're lucky enough to live in the Northeast, you can visit gardens from April through November with us.
And on any one of those days, it's like 4 to 6 gardens.
That's right. Yep, there's a lot. You know, in where the gardens are smaller, like in Charleston, we'll have 10 open on a day, and that's more of a walking tour. But we take into account that people like to linger in a garden. Our average visit is about an hour in each garden. So people like to linger. They love to take photographs, make notes, talk to the garden hosts. It's a very pleasant, leisurely pace.
And then at the end of the day, those gates close and you have to wait another year for a chance to see what's behind them.
That's right.
It is a wonderful Brigadoonish idea that I've always enjoyed. Laura Palmer is director of the Garden Conservancy's Open Days program, where on a single day of the year, local private gardens are open for you for that single day to walk through for a mere $5 to raise money to preserve private gardens around the country. You can learn more at either of their websites, whether you go to gardenconservancy.org or opendaysprogram.org. All the information will be there. And, of course, we'll put up a link at our website as well. Laura Palmer, director of the Garden Conservancy's Open Days program. Thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden again.
Thank you, Mike.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, an honor and a pleasure, sir.
The honor and pleasure is all mine. Ian, where are you, man?
I'm calling you from the Buckingham Township, outside of the New Hope, Lahaska area of beautiful southeastern Pennsylvania.
A beautiful place to be on the weekend, unless you happen to live there, and then you can't wait for Monday for all the tourists to go home.
Hey, Mike, I just got to tell you real quick, man. You know, in organic gardener circles, you are a bit of a rock star. So I'm as excited to talk to you now as I would have been to meet my favorite, you know, athlete or musician when I was younger.
Well, you have low aspirations, Ian, and I'm glad and I'm glad we could meet them. So what's up? What can we do you for?
I need your wisdom here, man. I have a garden that I've achieved about 95% organic status in, and I'm this year for the first time studying some of the biodynamic and sustainable methods.
Mm-hmm.
In our first growing season, this is my fourth garden I'm tackling in my life by myself, and this is the most amount of land we've had to do it on. We're in our first season here in Buckingham Township. When we moved, it was during the snows, and as I'm wont to do anywhere I move to, I like to put out the sunflower seeds and the suet for the birds. My children, Solomon and Sophia, who are toddlers, absolutely delight, especially in seeing, say, the cardinals or the blue jays out there when there's snow all over the ground. So I religiously fed these birds, you know, throughout that season, and now we're here. And I'm asking you if I have a fatuous notion about feeding birds in the springtime. My father, Howard, out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who's a veteran garden, tells me that I am to stop feeding the birds when it comes, you know, time for our gardens. His logic or argument being that if you remove that artificial food source, they will begin to pay attention to the bugs and the other, you know, native normal food sources that they would have during the season. My thinking is that I think that if I leave it out, maybe it will in some way keep the birds' attention away from my garden.
No.
Is this a silly notion, or would you go my dad's route?
Father knows best, Ian. First of all, make sure you don't feed sunflower on any type of growing area.
Yes, sir.
Sunflower obviously. Seed waste can have the same effect as the roots of a black walnut and stunt mm-hmm. the growth of nearby plants. Now, I think your father is right on. My philosophy, which is not completely popular with everyone, because like you, a lot of people just want to feed the birds. They want to see them out there all the time. And I think you can, but if you want birds to be helpers in the garden, then what I advise you to do, what I've kind of put together over the years, which is as soon as the weather gets cold, you fill the trees with suet feeders. You just go nuts. Mm-hmm. You can't put out too many suet feeders. You are mm-hmm. going to see chickadees, the titmouse, every kind of woodpecker, wrens. I mean, all these fabulous birds. And what will happen because of the timing? You're feeding them now when food is scarce.
Sir.
So then they will begin nesting on your property as the winter ends and spring begins. Then you take down the feeders, and the birds will not go away. They've enrolled their children in the local school district. I mean, they paid their taxes for the year. They have a little satellite dish pointed south from their nest. They're not going to go anywhere. And okay. now it is perfectly natural for them to go and eat bugs, and they eat some of the worst garden pests. If you read through any old farming or gardening book from the turn of the century, there will guaranteed be an entire chapter devoted to attracting the farmer's friend, which is birds. And now the bonus round, food is not scarce for them in the summertime. They'll eat bugs, even the seed eaters. The seed eaters, by the way, will eat that suet too when they're nesting and raising their chicks. As the summer progresses, there's plenty of natural food around. You want them to be eating your pests and food. They are not pests of anything other than blueberries and cherries in the home garden, and they need to be protected from birds. But one thing that birds need in the summertime that we don't think of is fresh water. Fresh water can be very scarce in the summertime. So right okay. in the middle of your garden, you should have a load of bird baths that they can use and keep them filled with fresh, clean water. Then you'll see the kind of antics that seed feeders can't even hope for. And
I like it.
Do the same thing at ground level. use bird bath saucers without pedestals and keep those filled with water. And then on a night when it's okay to take your kids out late, take them out to the garden, and late in the season, I almost guarantee you're going to find toads, little toads and frogs hopping around those low-to-the-ground water sources. And those are also fabulous pest controllers. If anything, I encourage people not to feed seed because it encourages squirrels. When bird feeders are out there, squirrels just go nuts, and then they start tearing up every garden in the neighborhood. But especially in the summertime, I think it's bad for the birds. It's teaching them to depend on humans who may stop filling the feeders or may move away or pass away. And in the summertime, the birds are good at being birds. But suet in the winter, lots of water in the summer, and you'll see more birds than with seed.
Hey, good info as usual, Mr. McGrath. I have about 16,000 other questions for you, but I'll save those for another day.
You just call us back, Ian.
Thanks so much for your time and your wisdom.
Take care, man. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that we're still looking for an original surviving copy of the Philadelphia Underground newspaper, The Drummer, from November 1974, in which I recount my tale of being in the Sigma Sound Studios the night David Bowie met Bruce Springsteen while recording the Young Americans album. But don't go looking through all those beat-up boxes in your basement just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls, the difference between straw and hay, and my take on straw bale gardening. Who am I? I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to Zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're on the stretch right now, ladies and gentlemen, cats and kittens, lords and ladies, everybody out there. Pretty soon, we're going to get to the question of the week. What is the real difference between straw and hay? Did I confuse them in a previous show? And what's the deal with this straw bale gardening? All will be revealed after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sandy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Sandy. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm just so happy that you're taking my call.
Well, I'm so happy that you made it. Where is happy Sandy?
Well, I'm in Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
Well, that's why you're so happy, of course, right?
I guess. Yes. I have brand new window boxes, two long ones that are each divided into three sections, and they're copper lined, and they have a drainage hole in each of the sections. But I don't know what to do. Should I? They're not standard sizes, so I can't put plastic liners, and I'm wondering about lining them with something, or do I just put dirt right in, or what do you think?
Were they meant to be highly ornamental? Were they meant to be displayed without plants in them? Why are they lined with copper?
I don't know. The guy just built them for me because I'd like to have window boxes out here.
Okay,
so that's what he did.
So somebody built them for you and lined them with, I presume, like copper flashing or something like that.
I guess. Yeah.
And what are the outsides made of?
Wood.
And there's one drainage hole in each one?
In each one, yes.
Okay. So the first thing is you probably want more drainage holes.
Okay.
Anytime you're dealing with containers, they never come with enough drainage holes. And I've never bought a container, even ones with really good drainage in the bottom, that I didn't drill more holes in myself. Because with containers, drainage is really vitally important. And you can control it. They must look beautiful as they are, right? Just with the copper and the wood?
Yes, they do. But they need some plants.
Right. Well, I don't think the copper is going to have a negative effect on the plants. And there is a great history of copper being used in what's called biodynamic farming and gardening. Way back when all these terms were getting sorted out, the natural style of gardening split into two schools. One was the German method. Rudolf Steiner, who also founded, I believe, the Waldorf schools and things like that, he developed this system that used heavily the phases of the moon and symbolic things that would be buried in the fields before planting, and copper to direct the growing energies of the planet into the roots of the plants. So you have become, by default, a biodynamic window boxer, Sandy. You may be the
good.
Only. You may be an association of one. So what you want to do is improve the drainage in those things.
Okay.
And then maybe go back to him because there's metal in there, too. So you're probably going to need two different kind of drill bits.
Okay.
And when you do that, just ask him to drill, like, make sure each box has three holes instead of just one.
Okay.
And ask him if he had any thoughts as to the copper, if he just thought it looked cool. But I don't see any reason to remove it. And remember, it's going to direct the plant's energy into
That's
the roots
excellent.
Of your plants. Now,
That's excellent.
You'll fill these with the same mixture that all containers should have. No garden dirt whatsoever. So
okay.
you want to go out and you want to buy what's called a soil-free mix or a potting mix, a nice, light, loose seed-starting soil, or that's organic, that has the letters OMRI on it. OMRI for the Organic Materials Review Institute. You want to fill your window boxes with half of that and half compost, nice rich black compost.
Okay.
And if you want to go the whole schmageggy, if you want to go the mile, buy a separate bag of what's called perlite. You know, when you get plants from the garden center, there's these little styrofoam balls down in the dirt.
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's perlite. That's actually an organic mined mineral that's popped in big ovens, and it tremendously improves drainage.
Okay.
So the best window boxes or any kind of container would be mostly half potting soil, half compost, and then, you know, a nice amount of perlite mixed in. You'll even see how much lighter it makes everything.
Okay.
As you mix the perlite in. But just make sure you find a nice potting soil that doesn't have moisture crystals or chemical fertilizer
in it. Okay.
And you'll probably do that at an independent garden center, not at a big box store.
Right.
That's where you'll find the real quality material.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank
good
you.
Luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sandy.
Thank you for talking to me. It's a pleasure. I've enjoyed your show a lot.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to meet a new biodynamic gardener.
Thank you.
Take care,
Sandy.
Enjoy
the spring. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine.
And where is Dan just fine?
I'm fine in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Oh, our good friends at WYSO out there. Very nice to hear from you. What can we do you for, Dan?
Well, I seem to have this problem that a whole lot of things that I plant just seem to immediately die or grow for a while and then suddenly die unexpectedly. I had some grapes I bought at seedlings that I brought at one of the local garden places, and I put in the ground, and they looked beautiful and healthy when I got them. But in 3 or 4, maybe 5 days, they died.
Huh?
And they were replaced by the provider there, and the replacements immediately died.
Let me stop you right there. These are grapevines that you planted?
Yeah.
And when you planted them, you dug a hole in flat ground. Then what did you do?
I've got an old pile of wood chips that are about 20 years old that look like dirt. I added a little of that with the dirt and just put them in there and watered them and waited for them to grow.
So you did water them well after you put them in?
Yes, I did.
And then the replacements died the same fast death.
Yeah, I've never seen the plant die so quick.
So you had a big pile of wood chips left over from when a tree came down or something?
I used to ask people whenever they chip trees to just drop it off.
Okay.
And that's what that's from.
And how bad is your clay soil? How poor is the drainage? Does water pool up and stuff like that?
Not really. It's not that bad.
And have you planted things that have survived?
Yes, I do have a lot of things that have survived, but I seem to have terrible luck here with all my vegetable garden stuff.
Okay, so in the vegetable garden, did you build raised beds? Or are you trying to grow flat earth style in clay soil?
I have so far been doing flat earth style. There's also been a kind of chemical spill a quarter mile away or so.
Ooh.
Everybody says there's nothing detected in the soil, but in some of the water, some neighborhoods away, it's a very small amount. They say it's safe.
Oh.
I wondered if that had anything to do with some of these kinds of plants dying so unexpectedly.
And certainly if it got into your water, yeah, I would pursue that. Now, that's obviously a public issue. Go to your local township, get some information. There may be litigation. I'm not suggesting that you would join the litigation, but the lawyers who are trying to protect the people who may have lost their drinking water and stuff, they'll have a ton of information that you can see about what might have happened. You've never had your soil tested, I presume?
No, I haven't.
Get a basic soil test. If they do a test for heavy metals for like $20 to look for lead and arsenic and those other things, that's fine. But, you know, you can't do pesticide or herbicide or unnamed chemical screenings without running into a lot of money. But get your soil tested. And this year, is there any chance that you would build some raised beds and get out of this soil to begin with?
I guess if that's what you think might be a good idea,
it's
always. My wife's been begging me to do it.
It's always a good idea. Flat earth gardening, you're always compressing the soil more by walking around your plants. Just go out and get some pavers or drop some frames on the ground and build boxes that are a foot tall and no wider than 4 feet. Fill them up with good, clean topsoil that you'll go get somewhere. And real compost, I would not go back to that used to be a wood chip pile.
Okay.
There may have been a lot of black walnut in there or other plants with allopathic properties that are, you know, harmful to other plants. And I'm always suspicious of wood in general. So don't go back there. Build a couple of raised bed boxes, frame them out with pavers or wood, and grow in those. And see what happens to your vegetable garden this year, and then pursue information about the spill. I would be very concerned about that, especially, are you on a well?
Yes.
Yeah, you got to learn more about that spill. Don't take no for an answer there. Before you get started, go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and under R, there's complete directions on how to build raised beds, super easy. Just install a couple of raised beds this year for your tomatoes and peppers and stuff. You won't believe how well they're going to grow. And then there's also information on getting your soil tested there, and I think you should do that. And again, you got to research what happened nearby and where you are with that. That could be your well is more important than a couple of dead grapevines.
Okay.
All right, man?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, good luck,
sir.
That.
All right, thanks. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Don't confuse straw with hay, or hay with straw. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, if you please.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Mary Beth, who lives in Spokane and listens to us on KSFC 91.9. She writes, Mike knows a lot, and I love the show, but he referred to hay and straw as if they were interchangeable on a recent program. Straw is a stalk, usually a waste product of wheat, that's used as bedding for barnyard animals. Hay, typically alfalfa or a grass, is used as animal feed. Mike, did you make this mistake? I can think of a lot of times when you've spelled out the differences between hay and straw, but never when you've confused them.
And luckily, I think I'm innocent this time as well. She's referring to a phone call we took on a show several weeks ago that was about, quote, straw bale gardening. I explained that one of my many objections to this technique was the fact that the original material was almost certainly sprayed with lots of chemical pesticides and herbicides. But I added that if you knew an organic farmer who baled their own hay, their straw would be clean of chemicals.
Wait a minute. Did you just confuse them again?
Nope. It's a fine point. Straw and hay both begin life the same way as a field crop. The word hay does refer to the entire harvested plant, including the seed heads. And most hay is grown to be used as animal feed, and it's generally something like timothy, rye, alfalfa, or a specialized grass. But cereal crops like wheat, oats, and barley are sometimes grown for animal feed as well as human consumption in things like bread and cereal. And when the plants are left intact and bundled up, they're hay. But when the seed heads are removed, the plant stalk that's left behind is straw, a hollow tube that has many uses, including animal bedding on farms and mulch in our gardens.
I get it. If the hay was grown to feed certified organic animals, any straw made from that hay would be free of chemicals.
Right. You have to have organic hay or grain before you can get organic straw.
And don't you always warn people to be careful that they don't get hay when they buy, quote, straw bales?
Oh, yeah. Straw and hay are often packaged up identically. And many garden centers and even farmers who sell their extra bales at the roadside use the term straw whether the bale in question is hay or straw. And if you use hay with all those seed heads intact as a garden mulch, the seeds will sprout and you'll become an unintentional grain farmer.
Didn't that happen to you once?
Oh, yeah. I hadn't yet learned that you have to really visually inspect the bales for seed heads, and I picked up a batch of hay that was labeled as straw. The plants that popped up a few weeks after I spread it as mulch taught me two important lessons.
Well, one was certainly to never trust signage, but what was the other one?
Wheat is sharp. Not a good plant to grab while you're angry barehanded.
Ouch! Let's move on to straw bale gardening itself. Eileen in Langhorne, PA writes, it's always a struggle to try and work our clay soil. I read an article about how this problem could be solved by using straw bales instead of schlepping bags of manure, peat moss, etc. to grow my tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers, but my husband disagrees. What's your opinion?
I think it's just another one of these trends that garden writers pick up on when they're desperate for something new to write about and that they didn't subject to any critical thought beforehand. But I was raised by a homicide detective, and I'm always looking for the hole in any logic.
How many holes did you find, officer?
Detective. And five right off the bat. The bales were almost certainly grown with pesticides, including these hideous systemic chemicals that are taken up by the plant itself. Two, straw bales don't retain moisture well. In a dry year, you're going to have to water them every day, perhaps several times a day. 3, but because straw is packed so tight, the core and bottoms do collect a lot of moisture that they can't get rid of, and those parts tend to mold up, especially in a wet year. 4, you have to buy new bales every year, which is far from sustainable. And 5, this system is lifeless. It's designed to avoid soil and compost in favor of feeding the plants with things like nasty chemical fertilizers.
And come to think of it, how could something like a straw bale possibly support a big heirloom tomato vine?
Okay, that's 6. Anyway, raised beds in real containers are a much less toxic and much more sustainable response to clay soil. Fill them with a nice mix of potting soil, screen black, topsoil, perlite, and compost. Then you're away from the clay, you're growing in a medium that isn't pre-contaminated with chemicals, that drains well in wet years, goes longer between waterings and dry years, and doesn't need to be replaced every year. And one that you can naturally nourish with compost and other organic matter instead of salty chemical fertilizers. Well, that sure was a fresh look at straw and hay, and a reminder that growing in healthy soil is the only true way to an organic gardener's heart. Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to bail me up if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And as always, should you send us an email, please, please tell us where you live. Please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Marissa Nicosia. I'm Mike McGrath, and yes, I was a rock and roll writer in 1974. Actually, that's when I was trying to get out of the business. I had already achieved my rock and roll goals by interviewing Pink Floyd in 1970, getting smacked around by John Lennon, which I deserved, and having Grace Slick throw a bottle of Chivas Regal at my head, which I did not deserve. Luckily, I'm still standing, and I hope to be standing still when I see you next week. Is plant-killing, home-staining wood mulch good for anything? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll go in search of a good use for what they're calling triple premium shredded bark, plus your fabulous phone calls.